Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to your leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Associate Editorial Director with Neurology Live. In this episode, we spoke with Dr. Robert Savodinov, the director of the Buffalo Neuroimaging Analysis Center and a professor of neurology and biomedical informatics at the Jacobs School of Medicine and Biomedical Sciences at the University of Buffalo. He discussed the CASA-MS study of a subgroup of patients with MS who developed rapid and progressive disability at a relatively young age, as well as the critical need to treat this group of patients effectively and much, much more. So let's dive in.
Let me first start by describing a little bit what the study is about, because this is really a unique study. Actually, such a research has not been done previously in MS. Everything started about a couple of years ago when our advisory chair, because we have a patient group who is advising us about importance of research and the needs for the patients, took us to Boston Home in Boston, Massachusetts, and that's a nursing home that hosts about 90 MS patients. Those people are all affected by severe MS, and it was pretty much in half an hour that we clicked so well with those people there and with the Boston Home leadership, and decided to do a study. And so this study was about 60 patients with progressive MS from Buffalo and 60 patients with progressive MS from Boston Home who really were age, sex, and disease duration twins, because they had exactly the same age, and it was always same patient randomized to the other twin in order to be fully mimicking each other. At the end, because of the inclusion and exclusion criteria, 53 and 53 patients ended the study. So coming to back to your number one question is, okay, what's differentiating them? And this was a very comprehensive, by the title, a study where we did a clinical, cognitive, biomarker, and clearly imaging study to understand why these people, and that was the key question, who have same age, same sex, and same disease duration, have so different disability. In fact, the Buffalo people had 5.1 on EDSS, and the Boston people had 8.2 on EDSS, so dramatically different disability. And the top line results that we are presenting today at ACTRIMS are showing that lesions, which are the usual suspect of disability progression and actually the major target of treatment for disease-modifying therapies, was not at all different between the two groups, as was not the whole brain volume, which is total amount of brain atrophy. So what was different, right? That's a natural question. So what was different was the amount of cortical volume. The amount of cortical atrophy in Boston Home patients was exponentially higher than in Buffalo patients. We also found a very affected thalamic volume loss in Boston Home patients, so thalamic atrophy, and actually a measure of structural connectivity of the brain, which is thalamic disconnectivity, was 2 to 3-fold higher in Buffalo people, which means they had better connectivity than people in Boston home. Finally, what we found is that a proxy of the spinal cord atrophy, of the spinal cord damage, medulla oblongata volume was substantially lower in Boston home people. So, you know, to put it very briefly and simply, these people, although everybody has progressive MS, everybody has same age, sex, and disease duration, there is more cortical disease, more severe cortical disease, and probably spinal cord or myelocortical disease that's ongoing in these patients from Boston home.
So I'm curious, obviously you talked about the cortical and the myelin aspects of things. We do have disease-modifying therapies for relapsing forms of MS. We're still working through a lot of things for progressive forms of MS. So are these areas in which you feel as though that industry leaders, you know, pharmaceutical companies should be paying a little bit more close attention to, considering the differences between the two groups?
So that's a very, very good question. And, you know, one of the reasons why we started this study was truly to come up with the new tools and evidences why the research has to be done in this patient population, and if so, how will be done and what tests will be used to demonstrate it. First of all, most of the people in Boston Home are not anymore on treatment. And the reason for that is because probably there is a common belief that in a very advanced stages of the disease, disease-modifying treatments are not very helpful and actually can also increase side effects, adverse events, potentially spasticity, and do more harm than good. One of the key points of the CASA-MS study was to show also, is this disease completely shut down? You know, there is no inflammation, there is no nothing ongoing, and these people really do not need a treatment, or there is still, you know, targets in the brain of these patients and spinal cord that can be really potential therapeutic target. I don't think we have yet the question, the answer to that question, but I think that one thing is sure, we need therapies that can potentially affect the cortical lesions, and that's kind of the next step where we are going with this research, because I think that now, you know, I have to say that this first phase of the CASA-MS used the MRIs that were not standardized from Buffalo and Boston Home because it was logistically challenging just to organize a prospective MRI study. But now, based on these results, we are going to really target much more sophisticated imaging protocols, including maybe 7 Tesla MRI to detect better cortical lesions, spinal cord damage, as well as maybe PET to recognize potentially is microglia still very active. And maybe when I begin to talk about biomarkers, I'm going to tell you a little bit more where we want to go with this, because we also did a very comprehensive a blood assessment of these people, as well as cognitive assessment of these people. So when it comes to your second question about therapeutic target, how you know that your drug is working on cognition of these patients when many of them cannot even, you know, express themselves and talk, etc. So in that direction, we created a new test for this study with Professor Benedict, who, you know, is a world-renowned neuropsychologist, and it's called ATOPS. It's an auditory test of processing speed determination, and we are validating that test versus the SDMT, symbol digit modality test, and in this study, majority, almost all patients from Boston Home could be assessed. Now, the point is that they had certainly much worse cognition than the Buffalo people, but I think that we need a test to test these people and be able, you know, to demonstrate then tomorrow if some treatment works.
Obviously, we have to see the things first and then get to the treatments afterwards. And hopefully, you know, like I said, hopefully there is more approaches sort of targeting some of those cortical lesions and things of that sort. Obviously, that you guys are really showing that that's sort of a main driver or main differentiating factor. I know you wanted to talk a little bit about the biomarker,
yeah,
which is where I wanted to go into next. And specifically, one of the things that I wanted that to me kind of stood out was your use of things like GFAP, which is starting to become a little bit more into the fold. So talk a little bit about the biomarker analyses as well as, you know, the introduction of GFAP, and could GFAP be used more frequently going forward?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So first of all, I would like to acknowledge our collaborator, Professor Kuhle from University of Basel, Switzerland, for the help he provided in determining both neurofilament light chain and glial fibrillary acidic protein in this study. I think it's really a top-notch examination in such a severe people. So while we found numerically higher NFL and GFAP in Boston home population compared to Buffalo, it was not significantly different. Now, let's underline that both population had substantially higher NFL and GFAP than probably a normal relapsing remitting population has. And I would say I didn't had time to look the literature, but I think the values of GFAP in Boston home patients are probably make the Guinness record in the literature because they were extremely high. Now, this is just the preliminary data we are presenting. We did not deep down dive into all the specifics, but we found and reporting that there was a correlation between the GFAP and gray matter atrophy and thalamic atrophy, so in Boston home people. So we will now look both groups together to see, because you know, the fact is that the Boston home people have very narrow EDSS. They are all in range between 8, which was our inclusion criteria, and 9.5. And you really need a bigger range to see a better correlation. And also the other thing that we want to look, some Boston home people, as I said, had very low lesion volume. So do you can we really go and stratify the patients based on amount of cortical and thalamic atrophy they have and really the amount of T2 lesions? One thing that we see in Buffalo people is that actually lesion volume correlates with amount of cortical and thalamic atrophy, but in Boston home does not. And that would suggest that really there are primary phenomenons driving probably pathophysiologically the type of disease that these severe people with MS have, that it's not so much related to primary accumulation of the lesions. Now, obviously, we don't have 27 years of disease duration to reconstruct everything retrospectively, but I think that all in all, the results are really super striking and interesting. For the first time, you know, demonstrating that really these people may be suffering from a different type of multiple sclerosis than usually MS patients, which leads to this level of disability, both cognitive and physical.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Zavodanov to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, after receiving a Type C written meeting response and clarifying feedback from the FDA, Acasti Pharma has announced it plans to submit the final clinical protocol that will ultimately allow it to move forward with a Phase 3 clinical trial assessing its investigational agent GTX-104 in patients with subarachnoid hemorrhage. Prashant Kohli, the company's CEO, said in a statement that we expect to move quickly to submit this final protocol and all required study documentation to the FDA. Next, because of safety concerns, the FDA has placed a partial clinical hold on the initiation of ibobrutinib, an investigational BTK inhibitor, in U.S. patients with MS who are new to an ongoing trial, as well as those with less than 70 days of exposure to the drug. EMD Serono noted that this decision does not impact the status of the ongoing Phase 3 Evolution trial program, which is fully enrolled, and results are still expected to be read out in the fourth quarter of this year. Next, the FDA's Peripheral and Central Nervous System Drugs Advisory Committee has voted that the current data on brexpiprazole, also known as Rexulti, from Otsuka and Lundbeck, an agent which is under review for Alzheimer's disease agitation, have shown enough evidence of benefit to outweigh the potential risks. The agent currently has a PDUFA date of May 10th, 2023, and if approved, would be the first agent specifically indicated to treat AD agitation. Next, the FDA has approved IntelGenx and Genesco's rizatriptan benzoate, known as Rizafilm Versafilm, which is an oral thin film for acute migraine treatment through the 505(b)(2) NDA pathway. This newly approved therapy is an orally disintegrating film formulation of the 5-HT1 receptor agonist designed to be bioequivalent to Merck's Maxalt MLT, which is an orally disintegrating rizatriptan treatment itself. Next, after being originally marked as a Schedule 4 controlled substance, the DEA has published its final ruling on fenfluramine, also known as Fintepla, from UCB Pharma, stating that the oral medication is no longer subject to the Controlled Substances Act. Following the receipt of this DEA rule, the company has filed a labeling supplement with the FDA to remove the Schedule 4 designation from the medication's label. Next, the FDA has expanded the indication for atogepant, known as Qulipta from AbbVie, to include the prevention of chronic migraine in adults, adding to its existing indication for episodic migraine, according to an announcement from the company. The approval was granted based on data from the Phase 3 PROGRESS trial that showed that 60 mg atogepant resulted in a significant reduction in mean monthly migraine days compared with placebo across 12 weeks of treatment. Next, the FDA has granted breakthrough device designation to Reach Neuro for its Avantis platform, a platform that delivers small electrical impulses to the spinal cord to restore shoulder, arm, and hand movement to post-chronic stroke patients. Early evidence has shown the effectiveness of the system in patients with chronic stroke up to 9 years post-stroke, outside of the 6-month window where existing therapies are currently used. And finally, the FDA has approved CSL Behring's 50 milliliter 10 gram prefilled syringe of immune subcutaneous immunoglobulin, known as Hizentra, for patients living with primary immunodeficiency or chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy, or CIDP. The treatment is the first and only immune globulin available in a ready-to-use prefilled syringe and comes in a full range of sizes to meet the needs of patients. For more information about these stories, you can head to neurologylive.com or you can check out the corresponding links in the show notes. And now, back to Dr. Zavodanov.
I mean, I think it's awesome. You guys are really just adding so many layers to things that we don't really know fully yet about primary or progressive MS just in general, which is obviously such an unmet need group in general, you know, compared relative to the relapse forms of the disease. You guys sort of, I know we talked about biomarkers, but in your own opinion, are there some issues with access to the resources that we needed to fully characterize these patients? Obviously, some of these things are not as cheap and as accessible as usual.
Yeah.
So is access to the resources going to be an issue going forward with trying to characterize these progressive forms of MS?
So that's coming to your first part, it's peculiar that only 5 patients from Buffalo and 3 patients from Boston Home had primary progressive MS. So majority of these people do not have primary progressive MS, but really secondary progressive MS that evolved rapidly to this point of disability. In terms of really resources needed, I think that a couple of things are to be mentioned. First, one of the spirit ideas why this research has also started was to demonstrate that enriching environment like is the Boston home and level of care they are providing to their residents is extremely important to keep these patients going. So while we focus in this first phase on the structural differences, biomarker differences, cognitive differences, and many PROs, which we even didn't report yet, we would like to also understand how the enriching environment, like it's the Boston home, helps these people couple with their disease for whatever they are left. Because I can tell you that many of these patients, when they come to Boston home, they are really on the verge of suicide, being abandoned, not being able to be served anymore even by their families, and they really need a constant care and a very professional care, which they are getting in Boston home. And how this care and enriching environment can actually promote whatever is left from their cognitive reserve to better couple with the disease. One thing that may be considered in the future is use maybe a portable MRIs, which we may decide to do in the second phase, and really go with the MRI to the Boston home rather than taking patients. Now there is, with the introduction of artificial intelligence, you can do really this, take this small equipment to the patient and do the scan, and with the use of artificial intelligence, much improve the detection of what you are going to see. But we are going to do also the 70 and really have two spectrums of the top-notch scanning that you can do and very basic, you know, war zone kind of scanning with the ultra-low field MRI. I think another interesting thing is to really understand, and this portable MRI could also help us more frequent serial scanning, right? That would help us understand better, you know, what's happening in those years when they are in such a state. Are there new lesions? Are there, you know, and you will not be able to do that just, you know, also because insurance would not approve those MRIs in such kind of population. So that's one idea that we are going to probably pursue. The other is certainly to partner with Boston Home in maybe selected number of participants who will obtain this higher, ultra higher field and more specific scanning, including PET imaging, which can give us much more molecular footprint of what's going on in their brains. And, you know, ultimately, we are not excluding to potentially, you know, also collect post-mortem data and for histopathological analysis. But we should go step by step. I'm also not excluding potential clinical trials. We are working also on some stem cell-related, you know, novel human oligodendrocytes, embryonic cell type treatments. So are we going to be able to bring these people back to at least become more mobile? I don't know. But understanding this population is certainly very important. And while we did the NFL and GFAP, there is so much more to do. You heard here about Epstein-Barr virus and so many other things that we did not yet explore, but have the blood collected for. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you could even get even more detailed with it, and I'm very excited to hear the next steps in your research and when the data does eventually come out afterwards. I think also the portable MRI idea is fantastic, and obviously that sort of gets around some of the previous issues of resources and access that we've already had in the past. You mentioned the things about insurance, which hopefully starts to alleviate over time. Dr. Zivanov, the last question that I have for you is, besides treatment options for this more progressive, severely formed, group of patients with MS, what are sort of the main current unmet needs that we still need to work on and still need to sort of figure out for the severely affected group?
I think the treatment is probably my top priority. Remyelination therapies are my top priority. Independently that these people are in a very disabled state, I have to tell you that I have been in Boston home several times and they are very happy there. So whatever day we are able to prolong in terms of their life in such an enriching environment as Boston Home, it is special, and these are special people. Unfortunately, through interviews like this and greater reach to the community, we need to also raise importance of studying this group, which has been for too long abandoned from MS research. And that's maybe my final message, that's why we started this patient center research. I think these people deserves to understand why they are these 5% to 10% of MS patients that are going to rapidly evolve to this stage of the disease, and what's so different in them respect to the, people who are much more responsive to therapies. We can't reconstruct after 30 years how many of them were on therapies, what therapies, and how this contributed to their story. But we know that some people in the Boston Home group are still on therapies, on disease-modifying therapies, and some are very, modern disease-modifying therapies, and that still does not help them. And that means that the whole approach respect to changing trajectory of the disease in such patient has to be redesigned and rediscovered.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, you can visit neurologylive.com.